Hello, America, and to all of our listeners all around the world, you're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host with the most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me as always is Filippo D'Onofrio, Patrick Mifflin, Teresa Sammons, and Chris Logie. Say hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey. Hello.
Hey.
Yeah, so it's been a hell of a week, hasn't it?
More stuff from last week.
Yeah, but that's not even – that's only half of it because some other major shit went down this week too.
Yeah.
So first thing you need to know, of course, is, yes, the ongoing impeachment saga is still ongoing, and we once again not got another week's worth of news stories to add to it.
Hmm.
Again, as I've said the last couple of weeks – this really does feel like what's going to finally take him down, simply because of just how fast everything is moving.
Yeah.
But also, it is one of the fun parts of this is just watching Trump and crew basically devour each other. Like,
oh, everyone, it is a magnificent thing to behold.
Yeah, they are legit. Like, just earlier, just like a couple hours ago, fucking Donald Trump just threw Rudy Giuliani under the bus, saying that people need to check his ties with Ukraine.
But aren't Giuliani's ties with Ukraine Trump's ties?
Did he just... his strong point, I'll just point that out.
He's trying to pawn it all off on Giuliani. That's what he's trying to do.
Yeah. No, if Giuliani goes down, Trump goes down with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. He's failing, for the record, because nobody is fucking buying it.
Yeah.
Except for maybe Trump's hardest of hardcore fanatics. And I'm going to be honest, that number is shrinking with every passing day now. But that ain't the only fucking huge thing that went down this week. Because if you've been paying attention to international news this week, you know that there's been some shit going down in Hong Kong for nigh about a month and a half now.
Mm-hmm.
And this week it finally started affecting the economy outside of the United States. Now, being that we are smash pad, you're probably thinking about that one really big thing that everyone knows about.
Yeah, we'll
talk and about. Rest assured, we will be talking about that, but that will probably be over on the Day Zero update.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we got the couple of others underneath that have also happened. And prepare yourselves, folks, because the Hong Kong shit is so fucking convoluted and, like, obscure in all of its myriad points and counterpoints that... to be honest, if you can't read Mandarin, you are completely okay. You are allowed to just throw your hands up and say you hope for the best. Seriously. But we're going to get to all that later. Obviously, we got some other shit to talk about. But as always, before we do all of that, must always start with what we've been up to this week of October 11th, 2019. Phil, what have you been up to this week?
So I started and finished Aurora CV-01 by Rick Brown.
Yeah.
That's the first book of his Frontiers saga, which I just found out is going to be 75 books.
Yeah.
How?
He is a crazy person.
Yeah. I mean, if Kaoru Kuramoto could churn out 130 books in the Gwyn saga, then this dude can definitely do it.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's been churning them out. He's got, like 23 of them out already.
Mm-hmm.
And he started in 2012.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's fair to point out that these are not, like, super huge, long...
So it's not dense.
No, it's not like that. But it's, like, basically every single book, well... at least from what I've read from the internet, it's kind of structured as like an episode.
Okay.
So it seems like he's kind of writing this as if it were a TV series.
Okay, yeah. That's fair.
Yeah, so it's pretty good so far. So
it looks like the hard paperback version is 300 pages.
Yeah, so it's not like, you know, hugely. Yeah, 300 pages, not a really long book. But, you know, my standards are like Stormlight Archive and Peter F. Hamilton. So, yeah.
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It may vary. But yeah, it's a good, very, very good book. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I'm going to start on the rest of them. Probably after the show. Maybe I'll start the next one, or maybe over the weekend. But beyond that, let's see, what have I been doing? Still playing PC Building Simulator.
Mm-hmm.
Santa Claus wanted me to upgrade his computer so he could play Deer Hunter Simulator. I was confused.
But, that's amusing.
Okay. I went with it. So that was funny. Apart from that, Mr. Robot started up again on Sunday. And at the end of the first episode, I thought this was going to be the shortest season ever because it looked kind of like it was ending in the first episode. So, yeah, that was pretty intense. Yeah, it's... This show does not fuck around. Let's just put it that way.
Nope.
Yeah. And, so I'm very much enjoying the hell out of this show, and I'm glad that it's back. The fourth season is going to be the last season, so I'm expecting that it will end on a pretty interesting note, given the characters that are in there and just the factions that are clashing. You got, like, Chinese government, you got Chinese organized crime.
Triads.
Yeah, you got American hackers. Yes. Uh-huh. It's a very
clusterfuck.
Yeah, it's a clusterfuck. Yeah. And this is happening like fourth season is taking place in 2016. And yes, the election is going to be part of it. So
it kind of has to be.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that gets. But yeah, if you've not tried Mr. Robot yet, stream it, download it, do what you got to do. Check it out. It's a really good show that goes places that you probably aren't expecting. Kind of it for me.
All right. Pat, what about you?
Well, in addition to receiving my annual reminder of aging today, I obviously Jonathan Hickman's X-Men reboot, relaunch, whatever you want to call it, has finished its prologue, and so I've just been digesting that and going back and reading all the issues for things that I may have missed. I'm still in the point where I'm going to be picking up all six books when they come out over the next month or so, and we'll probably be sticking with at least half of them for the long haul. So Marvel has done it. They've made me a regular comic buyer again.
Yeah.
And once you guys get caught up on it, I really look forward to unpacking it on this show because there is a lot to unpack.
Oh yeah.
Especially the big reveals in the final issue, Powers of 10, number 6. And I didn't think there was any chance in hell that that the relaunch was going to start where it's going to start, but here we are. So, yeah, that's been my week.
All right, Teresa, what about you?
I've been playing that damn goose game.
Everybody's been playing the damn goose game.
Everybody has. And I can't go further, so I've had to go back to the garden, and I'm trying to figure out how to get the gardener to wear his damn sun hat. So that's where I am. But it's funny. I mean, it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I wanted to fuck up the little kid, but you know, he just goes and cowers in places and falls around in puddles and shit. But I don't know. I wanted him to fall over and I wanted to like dance on his corpse, but he's not dead. So yeah, this game is making everybody crazy. and then when I get pissed off because I can't figure out what to do with it, I've been playing Let's Go Pikachu. I mean, we bought it like what, freaking a year ago or something, and I didn't pick it up until this week. And so, you know, it's pretty much old hat since it's based off of the original. But I kind of like it though. I kind of like it. I like the update. Seems like that's a little bit of a theme, maybe. You know, updating old Game Boy games.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a thing. And I've been playing Clash of Clans, which I'm almost embarrassed to admit, but, you know.
That's still a thing.
That is still a thing, and I still am not spending any fucking money on it either. No, thank you. But as far as not game stuff, we've been running through this season of Disenchantment and enjoying that. It's nice. I really like when Jerry goes to heaven and starts giving God hell. It's like, so you invented cancer? Yeah. You're a dick. It's pretty much like that.
Yeah.
And then I have picked up some of the X-Men comic books, and I have only managed to read House of X so far, number one.
And how's that got you thinking?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, Magneto's going to do his own shit. You already know that's going to happen. He's never going to go along with Professor X, ever. That's his thing, though. That's his freaking thing. You guys are laughing, and now I'm...
Well, the entire concept of this is to pretty much change what everyone's entire thing is.
Yeah, but...
So I'm just going to let that comment hang.
Okay, but he's still Magneto, so we'll see what happens. But he has some
great moments, too.
Yeah, I really liked how it started. Absolutely intrigued and must read the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much it for me this week.
All right. Chris, what about you?
Yeah, so let's see. I went and saw Joker earlier today.
Mm-hmm.
And it is pretty good.
Yeah.
I'd say it's probably the second best of the live-action Jokers behind Heath Ledger's.
Yeah.
So not quite there to that level, just because it's kind of a prequel. It's kind of this character kind of... falls into his madness and becomes the Joker.
Yeah. Then again, I mean, Heath Ledger's Joker is a really high bar to cross. So. Yeah.
But still, I think that's kind of better than what's his face from the Tim Burton movies?
Oh, Jack Nicholson?
Yeah. I think I like this a lot more than that. And the others are kind of just all the older ones from the Adam West show are kind of just, you know, Jokers.
Goofy.
Yeah. Campy and all that, in a way that, yeah, this one works really well and kind of, if they want to throw out Jared Leto's Joker and put in Joaquin Phoenix's Joker into the next Batman movie, mm-hmm. it would actually work pretty well. Because they, too, tie it back into the Wayne family. So there's some neat stuff in that essence, though. It also kind of sets this weird age difference between Joker and Bruce. Because this is kind of set in the, I guess, like the 70s? Where,
early 80s.
Yeah. Like
it's when, the early 80s.
Yeah, when like the New York version of Gotham is in a shithole.
Yeah.
And sort of everything is shitty. Tensions are tenuous between like the downtrodden and the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And all that, which leads to a lot of weird moments where, like, are they making political statements in this movie? Are they, like, being like, oh, we're apolitical, but totally making, you know, these references to, obviously, like, clowns?
Well, that's a big thing. The thing about it is Todd Phillips himself has said before that the reason he got this project off the ground was because the basic overall idea behind the movie originally had nothing to do with the Joker or the Batman continuity at all. It was just the idea of a, you know, bad comedian going crazy. So there's part, yeah, and people have told me who've watched it is that it really does seem like there are parts of it that are kind of sort of like it's like they cut and pasted the Batman and Joker stuff on top of something that was already existing.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's very much like Thomas Wayne is a big figure in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
As sort of a backdrop of the, you know, the quintessential rich person that all the lower class, the poor, that are mad at as their sort of figurehead of the entitled. Mm-hmm. Because he stupidly calls the poor people clowns.
Yeah.
And plays them right into the hands of the Joker.
Yeah.
As he
who, by the way, they actually, like, a good way of explaining like some of his quirks, didn't they?
Yeah, he has kind of a bunch of mental issues.
Yeah, the big one is that he has a like why he's always laughing. There's
he has like an issue that causes him to laugh at uncontrollable moments.
Like yeah. Which, part by the way, is an actual condition, yeah. By the way. That is
he has
actually,
like a card that he
it's a neurological disorder. Yeah.
He has mm-hmm. like a card that he hands to a woman who's getting kind of mad at him for laughing. It's like, yeah, I have this condition. It's not anything I can control sort of thing. And she fucking keeps the card, even though it says give it back to the person. Give it back to him, that sort of thing. But yeah, very much a guy who has a very shitty life. And kind of breaks at a certain point in a way that kind of makes you, I don't know, feel for him, but you understand, like,
yeah,
how it happens.
It actually gives him, like, a good, solid origin story.
Yeah.
Like
and there have been so many attempts at that over the years.
Oh,
that,
yeah. So much so that fucking the Joker himself says in The Killing Joke is that if I want to have a past, I want it to be multiple choice. So,
yeah. And that's like the joke in the with Heath Ledger's character, Heath Ledger's Joker is he just tells people a bunch of different origin stories for how he gets the scars.
There are clues to that point to an actual one though.
Yeah,
but that'd be a whole other podcast.
Yeah, here it kind of leads into the origin story of Batman.
Yeah,
in a way that's more interesting than. Like how all the Spider-Man movies before the Disney ones were kind of all, here's the origin story. We got to do this for like the first 45 minutes to an hour, and then we'll get into the fun stuff sort of thing. Like here, it's not always been a big part of Batman's, in the films at least, his thing. Other than just being like, this is the thing that happened, kind of just quickly do it. But yeah, this movie is pretty good. I'm curious to see if they do anything more with it, because I definitely think Matt Reeves' Batman could do with if they're ever going to put the Joker in that, they probably won't for the first one, I would assume. Because that just makes more sense to go with some of the other characters instead of going to the one villain that everybody likes kind of thing. But yeah, that at least Joaquin Phoenix's Joker is... more interesting than I would have thought. Sort of one of the best of the DC movies so far, even though it's not really branded as a DC movie. When it first starts up, it's very much branded as like a Warner movie.
Yeah.
With a lot of like late 70s, early 80s like movie branding kind of stuff. The way they do like the font work of the intro and all that. That movie's pretty good.
From what I've read, the idea that they have is they're gonna have like a specific label that they've created specifically for movies like The Joker. I think they're calling it like DC Alt or DC Dark or something like that. Specifically, it's movies that are not necessarily canon and are. Use DC properties for more experimental material. So, yeah.
Why not just bring back the Vertigo brand?
Well, for the movies, but yeah, they could do that.
Yeah, but yeah, that's it's just kind of hilarious that this like non-canonical movie shits all over 80% of the DC universe stuff.
Yeah,
in just a way that's kind of like, yeah, you guys. Really shit the bed by just having one director make all the movies for the first few at least and not having a variety of voices in the pot sinking the ship just as you figure out how to not do that with getting the Wonder Woman Shazam and some of those other movies out there but yeah I also watched El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie. That's on Netflix, and that is fantastic. It is a follow-up to the original series, where in the finale, Jesse Pinkman managed to get away in an El Camino. I guess Walter White's El Camino. It gives you a recap of Breaking Bad, particularly Jesse's side of it as it's about to start. And yeah, you get two kind of storylines, one telling you like directly what happened to him after he left there, and one that's kind of a bit more his side of some of the events that lead into the finale of the show, because he disappears for a while. So you kind of see like what happened with him, mostly when he gets captured by the group that kills Hank and all of them, I think it is. The show's great. This movie's great. Mm-hmm. And it kind of ends concisely where it's like they're probably not going to do anything else with this, with Jesse. Mm-hmm. But kind of gets him to a good place where you're like, all right, that's good for Jesse to get out of this whole hellhole that he was in for the last few seasons. Mm-hmm. I've also been watching Carmen Sandiego. Season 2 is out.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found out when I was, after I finished El Camino.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, let's just start this up. And it's still really good. The season kind of just follows off of what happened with last season, where one of the faculty kind of leaves Vile. Mm-hmm. And kind of joins up with Carmen Sandiego, and they're kind of doing their thing, kind of trying to foil Vile's attempt to steal Big Shit.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever they're at, and I'm on episode 9 of 10 so far, and I have an idea of where they're going to go for the finale, but I'm looking forward to finishing that up. Mm-hmm. They do some smart stuff, like let's say the spy agency that's kind of been tracking Vile and Carmen Sandiego kind of finally figuring out, like, hey, she's not actually the bad guy here. She's not actually working with Vile anymore. Maybe it's a smart idea to kind of recruit her to help us a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Here and there, and just instead of making completely wrong assumptions constantly and looking like fools. But yeah, that show's still really quite good. I'm going to definitely finish that up. And yeah, this week been doing a lot of streaming. Sunday played some more of the Frostpunk. Which was good, because I got off to a much better start than I did on my first save. But kind of petered out around day 10 when I ran out of food. Because I got a bunch more people in from the first like rescue I did, and did not set up more hunters to go get more food.
Well, that's
so we were basically scraping by. Basically, like, certain points you get to critical moments of like food or shelter or temperature or some of these other stuff. It gives you like a quick little mission, like, hey, in the next 3 days, you need to feed all the people that are starving, sort of thing, which is why when you bring in food, you're like, all right, I just need all these starving people to get this food, not the other people that don't really need it, just to finish off that quest. So I don't think you really get anything too negative out of it, just it bumps up your discontent bar a bit. But that's kind of where I was petering out on that. It's like, all right, I'm glad I made a save earlier in that run, so I could just start from there and kind of use my knowledge of what I was doing to make a more efficient run. Tuesday, played some Concrete Genie, which is one of the new releases this week, and that game is great.
Mm-hmm.
Stylistically, it reminds me a lot of, like, what is it, Kubo and the Two Strings?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like in the cutscenes, the main character has very much that kind of style, and his facial animations are very stop motion-y, which just looks great. But the rest of the game is kind of more traditional 3D platformer, action adventure kind of thing, where you are collecting these pages from his book, filling up, and using those with your like magical paintbrush to paint up on the walls. And along the way, you find these spots to create these genies. Mm-hmm. Hence the name of the game. That help you destroy barriers or power up stuff to get you through the next area kind of stuff. You're kind of going through, kind of, getting the power all around, revitalizing areas, and getting all your pages to fill out the all the different things you can kind of paint on the walls. And yeah, that game is just a lot of fun. It was kind of a surprise how good it was. But yeah, that's and yesterday I streamed Indivisible, a new game from Lab Zero, who made the Skullgirls games. And this time they decided to make kind of a an action RPG, kind of in the vein of Valkyrie Profile.
Mm-hmm.
And it works out really well. It takes a bit to get used to it once you get the full four character party, and kind of mastering the mechanics, because there's a boss battle early on that requires you to be on your shit, and I was not on my shit because I'd not fully grasped the mechanics of what was going on. Because they teach you this this whole thing where you hold L1 and you get all your party members to block for incoming attacks. So I just kept doing that. Didn't realize it was draining my meter to do special attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting to this boss fight where they seemed to get the first hit every time. So I was down 100 HP every single time I started this fight. So I was like, there's got to be something I'm missing, because this is really fucking hard when you have characters that do not have much HP and they're your healers. And you're not understanding like how to actually use their healing abilities, because it doesn't do a great job of explaining some of the abilities. Because when you look at your party formation, you can see like what their special abilities are, and it would tell me like, "Oh, this character's one is to heal your party." I'm like, "One? What the fuck button is that?" And that means you go into the focus mode, mm-hmm. and you have a full bar, and you hit their attack button once to do that. Special. Some will have better stuff for two or three, depending on how many attacks you can do at once, if they have them all filled up, that sort of stuff. But yeah, in between fights, there's a lot of platforming, a little bit more Metroid kind of style stuff, where you get abilities to open up new areas and all that. So it works out pretty well. And just once you get through the learning curve of the battle system itself, it's a lot of fun. Managed to get to, I think, six characters I have right now. And they've got some pretty cool abilities. The one I have on my bench is very much a healer, first and foremost. Like, one of her attacks is her, like, powering up her heal. She does this, like, churning stuff for her medicine. But she does it at the enemy to do some damage for them. So, and that game is just building up on the Skullgirls kind of animated, hand animated style.
Mm-hmm.
It just looks really good. So that's been kind of it. How about you, Brad?
All right. Well, first and foremost, I finished Control and 100%ed it too. So that is literally the second game I've 100%ed in like, what, 15 years?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But to be fair, though, the trophies in that game are not very hard to get. Yeah, if I was to be completely honest.
Is it just like do all the things?
Yeah, it's like do all the things and then like do this one thing 10 times. Yeah.
Nothing really like this thing. Beat this on the harder difficulty and beat this on the even harder difficulty and do it without getting hit and no bullshit like that.
Yeah, no.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. I still highly recommend it, though. It is definitely a very fascinating, interesting game with both a lot of potential and a lot of lore going on inside of it if you're willing to go look for it.
Yeah, I think that's going to be like a Black Friday game I'm going to get when it's on sale then.
Yeah. And yes, they have, in fact, it is actually takes place in the same universe as Alan Wake. So that is confirmed in-game. But anyway, so I finished that, so I decided I needed to do some shit in my backlog, and so I went to GameStop yesterday, and I went and got Marvel Spider-Man.
Nice.
PS4, you know, the Insomniac game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that game's
and,
great.
Yeah, and you know what? I really don't have to say anything about it, because Dan Red did all the review and did all the work for me. I will absolutely say that my first looking at it was absolutely confirmed in that, yeah, it is kind of a copy and paste of Arkham Knight, of the Arkham games, basically. Just the feel is different, and it's a lot more like upbeat and positive. Whereas Arkham is Arkham.
Yeah, I would say it's a lot more improvisation in Spider-Man. You can kind of go into each battle differently if you want to, a bunch of different ways, depending on how you spec yourself.
It's easy though. It is not easy at all.
No.
Oh, fuck me, no. It will kick your ass if you are not paying attention.
Yeah.
And it will still kick your ass even if you are paying attention. But, yeah, it's definitely a lot of fun. Much like with the Arkham games, there's a lot of, like, lore and stuff you can go around and find. Collectibles, that type of thing. I got the Game of the Year edition, which comes with the DLCs. So there's that going with it.
It's one of those games where you can get the 100% without having to even do all the content.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to check out most of it.
Yeah. I will say, though, that it's very obvious what work went into what character models and what work didn't go into what character models. And I'll just leave it at that. Because that's like the one mark on an otherwise fantastic game. And, you know, it's pretty much like the first genuinely good Spider-Man game we've had in God knows. Yeah, generations now. Like, the last really good Spider-Man games were, like, the ones for the Tobey Maguire movies.
Yeah. I remember playing the one for the first movie and then going to go see the movie right after that.
Yeah. Now, if only they could do that for fucking Superman.
Well, here's my take on it, because you touched on the whole comparison with the Arkham games.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that we're just kind of zeroing in on the idea that this is the proper way to make a superhero video game?
Yeah, probably.
At least for the ones that are melee focused.
Yeah, because this is, you know, the idea of like what a, how, you know, because the thing about the Arkham formula is it does let you actually sort of experience being in a superhero in a way that doesn't feel generic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because consider this. Up until all of the the first Arkham game came out, all of the Batman games that had come out at that point had basically been like other versions of a game with Batman pasted on top of it.
Yeah, like brawlers.
Yeah, it was like a brawler, or there was that I think it was like one of the first Batman game for the NES, which was basically a Ninja Gaiden clone. It was a good one, but it was still a Ninja Gaiden clone.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's like the really awful like Batman Forever.
There's a weird one that's on the PS1 that's like a weird open world game.
Yeah.
The open world game that before anybody knew that those were a thing people wanted.
Yeah.
And how to make a good one of those.
There was also the game that was based on the animated series that was actually really good.
Yeah.
But again, that game was just sort of a retread of like some of the other ones. And as for Superman, the last good Superman game that existed was on the fucking Super Nintendo. And like even that game was basically just a Final Fight clone, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
because he's known for just going street to street and just beating up punks.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I could do my dream game, it would basically be like a superhero game, but it would be like a superhero version of The Witcher, where, you know, it's like, you know, think of like something like an original superhero property, something like what are those games Sucker Punch put out?
Infamous. Sly Cooper?
Or Infamous? No, Infamous, yeah. And doing that, but it's got, like, the scale of The Witcher where, like, what you do will affect the plot. And, you know, you can – there's, like, a bunch of characters and storylines, and you can occasionally nail hookers. Like, that would be my dream game.
Okay, then.
TFI? TMI? Was that TMI? That was probably TMI. Okay. All right. Well, next up, I watched Sweeney Todd. Wait.
So what you basically want is something more or less inspired by The Boys.
Yes and no, because the thing about The Boys is that it's based far too much on, like, real, actual superhero lore. I want something that's completely original.
Okay.
Because literally, like, all of the hero characters in The Boys are just
dead. So I figured that would get the tone perfect.
I mean, it would get the tone right, but...
Not much else. Not
quite. Yeah. But anyway, so, like I said, other than that, I watched Sweeney Todd this week. Any guys ever seen Sweeney Todd before?
I have not.
Okay, Sweeney Todd is a... Originally, it's like a musical by Stephen Sondheim. And it's a... The one I'm wondering is one that Tim Burton did a couple years ago. It was, like, really successful. It's got Johnny Depp, and Helena Bonham Carter.
I'm pretty sure that that Tim Burton thinks that they're the only people in the acting business.
Either that or Christina Ricci. It's like, yeah, pretty much. But Sweeney Todd is like a really fucking dark story that Stephen Sondheim managed to turn into a musical that somehow manages to also be really funny at the same time. Because, like, Sweeney Todd, the character, has been around, like, since the 1800s. And basically, he is a barber who randomly kills some of his customers and then has a trap door at his barber's chair that then sends them down into the basement where his accomplice, Mrs. Lovett, then turns them into meat pies that she sells at her shop. It's really fucking good. Okay. Would you believe I actually auditioned for the musical for my high school's version when I was a senior?
Yes.
You absolutely believe that. Yeah. It's true. I did. I didn't get the part. But I know like half of these songs backwards and forwards now. But yeah, if you ever get a chance, great movie. Watch it. Or watch the, like if you can get a hold of like the original the version of the musical from like 1980, give that one a try too. It's got Angela Lansbury playing Mrs. Lovett, and it is Angela Lansbury as you have never fucking seen her before.
Clearly.
There's such a thing in theater as saying playing to the back row. Angela Lansbury in her role basically plays to the people in the park two blocks down from the theater. But,
that's fantastic.
Yeah. But anyway, other than that, books, usual reading. Been rereading a book called House of Leaves, partly because of Control that I've been playing. Have I talked about this book before? I think I may have talked about this book before. It's a book by a guy named Daniel... what's his name? Mark Z. Danielewski. There we go. I knew it was a fucking weird name like that. And it's basically what it is. It's one of those like really super meta postmodern books where it does a lot of like mixing up media and stuff in its pages. It's basically got like three storylines running concurrently with each other. It's basically about this guy named Johnny Truant who works at this tattoo shop who, while he's rummaging around in like the basement of the building, he discovers a manuscript that looks like it's almost a decade old. And manuscript is this it's like a scholarly dissertation on this documentary film called The Navidson Record, which was made by this guy named Will Navidson. Basically the basic of this documentary is that his wife Karen and their two children, Chad and Daisy, move into this house that they discover while they're moving in that the inside of the house is actually bigger than the outside of the house by about a quarter of an inch. And what this ends up doing is that on this discovery, they suddenly start seeing things like closet spaces that look like they go on forever, or like a hallway that seems to be a never-ending series of door frames. Or like they start seeing like the wallpaper start aging much faster than it's supposed to be. Shit like that.
And it was not just potting those brownies.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. The guy who wrote this dissertation on this film, his name is Zampano. He's blind, like totally blind. And apparently Will Nevinson, the movie, never actually existed. So there's all like these sources and stuff that apparently don't exist. And it just gets fucking weirder from there. this is one of those books that, you know, you have to read sort of, you have to go through pages more than once, mostly because of like the way that the typesetting is done. Like, okay, let me tell you, there's like a sample page here somewhere, I think, to show you like what is like average for this, because it is like really fucking weird. Okay. So like, right here, I'm going to show you this. This is a sample page. Well, sample pages of from, I think it's page 128 and 129. Did I have to get this out of Goodreads? But yeah, it's just, if you ever find a copy of this fucking thing, like, get it, because it is just so, so fucking weird. God damn it. Okay, here we go. Had to get it off of Google Images. Okay, this right here, this is like not abnormal for what a page in this book looks like. Yeah, you see that? That's fucking normal for this book. Yeah. All right, so other than that, well, I've been enjoying this wonderful weather that we've got now, because asshole summer is finally left, and it's actually pleasant outside now. In fact, today, the highest it got was only 83. And the highest it's only supposed to get tomorrow is around 88, and then it's going to be falling after that. Because, like, this time next week is going to be in the 70s. Hmm. So, yeah, fucking awesome, ain't it?
Yeah, normal weather is it's nice to have every now and then.
Yeah. I've actually been able to go out and start working out regularly again. Mm. So, very nice.
Yeah.
Very, very nice. I am so fucking happy it's all fucking over. And the best part is we didn't have to deal with a fucking tropical storm this year.
Yay.
Hooray.
No power outages, well, or anything.
Nope. Unless, of course, you live up in the Northeast, because you're supposed to get hit with something hard.
They kind of whiffed on Georgia.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so anybody got anything else they want to add before we move on?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, then, it is now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And today, well, tonight, depending on, you know, what time you're listening to this, I want to very briefly discuss and sort of demystify a certain book. It's a book you've probably heard about. Probably heard about it when you were, you know, doing your government or social studies classes, when you were, you know, in high school. You may have seen it on a book rack. You may have seen it as like the source of like a million different conspiracy theories. You may even have read it yourself and been surprised and looking at it and thinking, wow, that's it? I want to talk about what is probably one of the most influential and probably one of the most misunderstood documents that had ever been published and widely read in the Western world. Its original title in the original German was Manifest der Kommunistischen Partei, or as we in English know it as, say it with me,
the Communist Manifesto.
Yes. Like I said, one of the most influential documents ever made, and also probably one of the most widely misunderstood. So, The first thing that you notice when you encounter this particular piece of writing is probably its bravery, or for that matter, lack thereof. Because unlike some of the like major world-changing books that have been published in the past, you know, like Plato's Republic or Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, you know, like these multiple hundred-page tomes that are basically bricks in book form and you could give someone a very serious head injury with. The Communist Manifesto is actually really fucking short. In fact, it's in reality, depending on what edition you pick up, it's usually somewhere between 20 to 45 pages long. Really, it's like that fucking short. And, you know, it's actually in the name because, like I said, the original title translates to The Manifesto of the Communist Party. And, like I said, it's exactly how it was. It's a manifesto of what was then a then-existing political organization called the Communist League in Germany. Well, I said in Germany. Germany technically didn't exist yet. The reason this book actually got published in the first place was because it was published in 1848. And if you don't know what was going on in Europe in 1848 at that time, well, it kind of puts all of this in the context. 1848 is sometimes known as the springtime of nations because all of these political revolutions were sweeping through Europe, specifically in Germany. Well, again, like I said, the German states, because again, Germany didn't exist that time. It was made up of Prussia, Austria, and a bunch of like different little areas that look like that. If you look back on them today, they look like a very poorly done patchwork quilt that someone stapled on top of a map of Europe. And basically, as all this shit was happening, the old monarchies were collapsing, and this one small organization, which itself was amongst a bunch of different organizations on the political left at the time, wanted to get their manifesto out and these ideas out into the ether because they all knew shit was about to go down and they wanted to get this out before the bullets started flying. And so what they did is they got in contact with two fellow travelers of the organization. A 30-year-old German philosopher and economist by the name of Karl Marx, who you probably have heard of, and his then, I think it was a 28-year-old friend and confidant, a factory owner by the name of Friedrich Engels. Sorry, I've been drinking. by the name of Friedrich Engels. And it basically is the what was meant to more or less be both the ideology and the sort of political program of what the Communist League at that very time was. So, and if you pick up any modern editions of this work today, most of them will begin with a preamble by Friedrich Engels himself, mostly noting about the fact that, you know, about the fact and time that this work was actually being published and why it was related and how some parts of this are actually kind of obsolete to the wider political left as it stands now. I'll get to that in just a second. So like I said, this work itself is roughly between 20 to 45 pages long, depending on what edition you pick up. In fact, actually, to be honest, if you do pick up edition in the modern era, the bulk of the book that you will have is not actually the manifesto itself, because usually the manifesto will only be like a third of the actual book. Usually what will also come with it is like a preamble, including the two preambles by Engels. You'll also have a bunch of like biographical sketches and usually a bunch of scholarly sources to sort of bring into context some of the stuff written in here.
So it's the definitive edition.
Yeah. So the manifesto itself is roughly divided into four areas. The first, now obviously, as everyone knows, the very as usually It usually starts with the famous entry, which is, there is the specter that is haunting Europe, the specter of communism. That's, it's like one of the most famous beginning sentences in all of world literature. And basically, the work says, you know, this is the new idea, and it's sweeping Europe, it's terrifying the masses, and here we're going to lay out what our basic program and ideals are. And so it's then divided into roughly four sections. The first one is called Bourgeois and Proletarians. And basically what it does is it explains sort of the rise of the capitalist system from what was the former system, which was feudalism. By the way, Marx is actually the guy credited with terming that term, capitalism. That's actually his quote. He actually coined that phrase. Basically the argument is that, okay, so capitalism formed out of feudalism because capitalism was the progressive force that overturned the old monarchies of Britain. This is sort of like a point towards what was the American Revolution. He then goes further to argue that history is shaped by who owns what, and that basically everything else is secondary to that and sort of branches off from that. And the modern division of power in, you know, this was 1848, was the two opposing classes, the two opposing social and economic classes. Bourgeois, that was the capitalists, those who owned the means of production and used them privately to earn profit, and the proletarian, which was the worker class, those who don't really own any substantial property of themselves and basically have to live off the wages from their labor. Now, Marx put forth the idea that at some point, the workers of the world will suddenly realize, hey, we're kind of getting the short end of the stick here, because I'm making a shoe factory where I'm making like $20 worth of shoes a day, and yet I'm only getting paid like $6. And all that other money of what I made is basically going to this rich fat fucker who barely does any work at all. And so the idea is that eventually people will realize, holy shit, we're getting screwed. And so they'll rise up, overthrow the capitalists, and then begin the process of building socialism, in which all of the workers will then, you know, take over ownership and control of the means of production. And that all of the differences between people, race, gender, nationality, religion, all this other shit, will basically wither away because people will suddenly realize, holy shit, we're getting screwed by these people. This then leads into the second section, which is proletarians and communists, which is basically his description of what communists and what communism is supposed to be. It's basically also partly a diatribe against those who are saying communists hate freedom, and basically saying that the one thing they are against is what they call, quote, bourgeois freedom, which is the freedom to exploit the workers and decide what to do with the fruits that of the labor they themselves produce without their consent. He then goes on against all the stuff that's alleged to it, so like class structure, the nuclear family, nationality, and traditional ideas. And basically him encouraging the proletarian to rise up and overthrow the ruling class. Now, this part here is kind of where people get messed up, because there's a list of 10 demands that come in this particular section. And the thing about these demands is they are very specific to the time and place that they were written. And in fact, in the preamble that Engels usually does in the editions you read now, he usually points out that these 10 demands are largely obsolete from the, you know, the conditions that they arose in. So basically ignore that part. And after that, there's basically the section known as socialist and communist literature, which is basically a whole section where Marx and Engels go and point at the other socialist tendencies that existed at the time and basically call them bullshit. Mostly because they're either too utopian or they're politically reactionary, that are basically wanting to bring in some some idealized form of feudalism back. He also points against German socialists who support they're called the petty bourgeois, which are shopkeepers, merchants. We would sort of in the modern era call them small business owners. He also doesn't like the idea of quote unquote bourgeois socialism, which is basically just charity. And again, he's also critical of utopian socialism, which is, you know, that idea of like a perfect world that will exist in perpetuum. And then finally, the last section, the fourth section, is the position of the communist in relation to the various existing opposition parties, which is basically him saying, look, if you are a communist or a socialist, you should stay true to your ideas, but it's also completely fine to be pragmatic and try to work with social democratic parties, and even if the bourgeois, if it gets you closer to their goals. And as it's quoted, communists everywhere should support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things. They should support democracy and not hide their goals. And finally, at the very end, there is that most famous phrase, the famous phrase that has emblazoned banners and slogans and poster boards and flags the world over for almost 200 years. Working men of all countries, unite. And that's the Communist Manifesto.
Wow.
Yeah. Basically, this book is so widely read. It's like widely translated. It is up there with the Holy Bible in being like one of the most widely translated and, you know, handed out political pieces of literature ever made. And like I said, it's also one of the most widely misunderstood, because the thing is, again, the manifesto only had one purpose, and that was to act as a political sort of manifesto for this particular group of this particular organization at this particular point in time. It also was published early in Marx's career, because his thought actually evolved a bit over time. Basically, I think a friend of mine basically put it this way. The Communist Manifesto is the statement. Das Kapital, which is the big, thick, like scholarly treatise that Marx did, is the proof. And that has been Brandon's random factoid.
Nice.
Very good.
Now go out and overthrow the capitalist scum. Workers have nothing to lose but their change. Did I say change? I said change.
You did, yeah. Well, but we knew what you meant.
Anyway. All right, now it's time to start the show proper, and as always, we start with our asshole of the week. And our asshole of the week is Trump and the Trump administration, who fucking stabbed the Kurds in the back and have allowed Turkey to basically start a second genocide.
Yeah, this is not good.
Yeah, this is like an issue that actually got a bunch of Republicans mad at him.
Yeah.
Which is a feat that is very rare to do this past few years.
So... he then tried to defend his actions by saying, look, man, the Kurds didn't really help us during World War II, which, you know, is really hard to do when you don't have a fucking country to call your own.
Yeah, exactly.
That and also, really... that was 70 years ago, you stupid bitch.
Exactly. Yeah. What a fucking shitty president.
Yeah.
I mean, what else can you say?
Yeah.
About sums it up.
Yeah. I mean, we really can't add anything to that except to say that Erdogan is a fucking, I hope he dies. Seriously. Like,
yeah.
God damn it, man.
Yeah, it's...
how he hasn't been taken out already, I'm not sure.
Fuck. And we got nobody to blame but us.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because...
when you have voter apathy, you know, the only people that show up are the easily swayed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's really not much more to add to that.
Nope.
And you got a dumbass who's in charge of the military.
Yeah.
And pulls these sorts of stupid moves with one of the few allies we have in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the few allies in the Middle East who have done the bulk of the fighting, might I add. Because that's the thing. The soldiers we have down there, they aren't combat soldiers. They're advisors. Yeah. It's the Kurds that have been shedding blood for all of this.
And sort of as a result of this, like a lot of the members of ISIS and such that have been captured are going to be let free. And
yeah, because the Kurds were the ones who fought and defeated them.
Mm. Yeah, but Trump thinks we've completely eliminated them. It's like, no, they're just captured.
Shit. Yeah.
They're going to be let free and they're going to keep doing what they're doing.
Quadruple their efforts. Yeah.
You've essentially just given them a whole new injection of steroids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stupid, stupid fucking bastard.
Yep.
God damn it.
What a loathsome human being.
Yeah.
Yeah, really is.
But fortunately, we do have our hero of the week, and our hero of the week is in Toronto. It's over in Canada in Phil's neck of the woods. There was a restaurant, a Syrian restaurant, that was going to shut down for good due to all these death threats from racist-ass motherfuckers.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But it's actually going to reopen with a brand new support and customer base.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is Sophie's, S-O-U-F-I, apostrophe S. So it was a Syrian restaurant that was beloved. It was featured in New York Times a couple of years ago. It was like a great example of what refugees can do in Canada.
Yep.
Kind of thing. And yeah, the son of the owner was at a protest for, a September event in Hamilton featuring the People's Party of Canada leader Maxime Bernier.
Oh, yeah, we should probably just very, very briefly, Phil, you should probably...
Yeah, fill us in on what that's all about.
There's not really much I can elaborate on there. It's we're going through an election cycle right now, so
yeah,
there are tensions are a little high because satisfaction with JT is not exactly it's not great.
He's pissed people off.
Yeah, and so this other party is basically she's kind of aggressively going after him, and that has just kind of led to. Some higher than usual tensions, we'll say.
Also, they're really fucking racist. That's like another thing you should probably point out. People's Party of Canada are really fucking racist. They're basically the Canadian version of like UKIP or Alternative for Deutschland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, so yeah, he was at this protest, and of course, right wingers. Managed to find out that he was one of the people there, the son of the owner of this restaurant, well-known restaurant, and claimed that he was abusing an old woman trying to get in, which he wasn't.
Oh, shit.
And that led to all this harassment getting sent to the restaurants, and they made a reasonable decision, like, this isn't worth it. They're going to shut down this week, as of this week. But at the last minute, good people stood up with help from, Marston. What's the full name here? Paramount Fine Food CEO Mohammed Faki, who has a downtown eatery in Toronto's downtown Queen Street West neighborhood. Sort of another immigrant that has made a good name for themselves and kind of being the support for them, helping them get the restaurant back opened up and hopefully much stronger support to keep them going through the hate that they're probably going to keep getting. He has had his own shit he's had to face. He won a $2.5 million lawsuit last May against a former Mississauga, Ontario mayoral candidate who made, as the judge described, hateful Islamophobic comments against him in an online video.
Gosh.
Kevin Johnston?
Yeah, unfortunately, Canada is not immune to racist bullshit like down here.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. Kind of being very much a white country like the U.S., any sort of influx of people that are different gets a lot of the old assholes angry for no reason.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, it sucks. But, got all these people coming into sport. That's awesome.
Yep.
It is.
Yep.
Yeah.
Especially someone who's technically his competition.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Sometimes you gotta stick with the people that best know your situation.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, moving on from there, we now start the proper show proper. And sadly, we have to announce the death of Rip Taylor, who passed away this week. I think he was 92.
88.
So, do you guys know who Rip Taylor was?
Isn't a band, wasn't he?
No, Rip Taylor was a a comedian and an entertainer.
Yeah, the guy who has throws a confetti all around the place.
Yeah,
all stuff.
He was a very, campy man with
voice.
Yeah, very campy man, mustache and flashy suits. He was a comedian. He would throw confetti all over the place. That was like his shtick. He was very active as a variety entertainer.
Wayne's World 2. He was like one of the key people trying like helping them save the festival.
He was around for a long time too. I think he got started in the 60s.
He's been around for about 60 years.
Yeah. He's one of those like variety entertainers who was always a part sort of like in the background of the entertainment world that everybody would occasionally just pop in places. They're like, hey, I remember that guy.
Yep.
It's sad to see him go, but he left a hell of a legacy. He was a walking human caricature.
But a good one at that.
Had a good one. Yeah. So, yeah. R.I.P. Rip Taylor. You will be missed. And now, for the part of the show you've all been fucking waiting for. Here we go. Impeachment Watch 2019. I think this is like segment 3.
Yeah. Yeah. John Oliver's got a name for this whole thing. It's Stupid Watergate 2. Even stupider Watergate.
Yeah. So, first things first, we found out this week that there is, in fact, a second whistleblower, and that this second whistleblower corroborates the first whistleblower.
Yeah, and has firsthand knowledge of what happened.
Yep.
Because that was, like, the thing that Trump and his allies kept going on. It's like, oh, there's secondhand allegations. It's all
and
hearsay and all this
shit. Coming in is like, nope. Like, no, I can totally corroborate everything this guy said.
Never mind that they put out the transcript that confirms everything that they said they didn't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is like, look, even if everything else flails, fucking dude, look at this.
Yeah. And also, don't forget the time when he did on national television what he said he was accused of doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Twice. Didn't he? Yeah.
Then... he threw Energy Secretary Rick Perry under the bus by blaming the Ukraine call on him.
I'm not sure.
Sure.
Okay.
Because it's not like you're the one in charge. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
They can't bully you into doing things they want
to
do.
It's also easy to do because Rick Perry is outgoing. He's supposed to resign by the end of this year. Hmm. So he's an easy target.
And he said, not a lot of people know this, but... I didn't even want to make the call. The only reason I made the call is because Rick asked me to. Something about an LNG liquefied natural gas plant.
Yeah, but...
following the president's comments, yeah.
Which is funny because in trying to throw Rick Perry on the bus, you incriminated yourself fucking again.
Yeah.
And then Washington Post put out a poll that shows... 58%, the vast majority of polling individuals, not only support the inquiry, but 49%, that's almost half, just 1% away, also support removal.
Yeah, 6% support just the inquiry, but not removing him.
Mm-hmm.
And opposing is 38%. We'll talk about another poll that cause a lot more shit in a little bit, but
yeah, we got a couple things to go through at first.
Still significant.
Yeah. Now, Senator Lindsey Graham has also said that he wants to invite Rudy Giuliani to speak to the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Ukraine bullshit.
I love how it's an invitation.
Yeah.
I also love how Lindsey Graham has no idea what he's actually inviting Giuliani to.
Yeah, it's one of those things like, yeah, Lindsey Graham likes to act like he has important opinions, and then he just does whatever anybody else wants.
Yeah.
He's very much a wilting lily.
Yeah. You know who else is on that committee?
Who?
Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Oh, by the way,
she's been waiting for a shot to get that Giuliani.
Oh yeah. Then the White House announced that they wouldn't be participating in the impeachment inquiry, which is, you know, tough shit, but it doesn't matter what you want.
Yeah, right.
The meme of the black eye point. So it's like, they can't impeach me if I don't participate.
Yeah.
Actually, no, that makes it easier.
Yeah.
Oh wait.
Basically means they can have you held in contempt, and they can get the sergeant at arms to lead your ass away in handcuffs.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've been basically telling some of the people, at least, that are being subpoenaed to talk to them. I think the one guy that's the ambassador to the EU, basically like, hey, you can't do this. You're not gonna not gonna talk to them. Then. He goes, fuck you,
I'm going to go talk to them.
Yeah, because he's a state official, so he has to listen to the people in the state offices telling him what to do. Mm-hmm. Like, eventually he's like, yeah, we're going to do this anyway because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And
plus, all
his
texts were released anyway, so people know exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
For the most part.
And next up, this was the first big bombshell, because we got one more that's the last one, and this happened, I think, yesterday.
Yeah.
The last one did. This one, I think, happened, I think, around Wednesday.
Yeah. This was News 10th, I think.
Yeah. Fox News released a poll from their website showing 51% support impeachment and removal of President Trump. Fox.
43% no.
Yeah.
6% no.
Fox News.
Yeah.
And Trump went fucking loony.
Yeah, here is tweets responding to this. From the day I announced that I was running for president, I have never had a good at Fox News poll. Whoever their pollster is, they suck. But Fox News is also much different than it used to be in the good old days, with people like Andrew Napolitano, who wanted to be a Supreme Court justice, and I turned him down. He's been terrible ever since. Shep Smith at Donna Brazil, who gave crooked Hillary the debate questions and got fired from CNN, and others at Fox News doesn't deliver for U.S. anymore. It is so different than it used to be. Oh, well, I'm president! Exclamation point.
And then he did another tweet where he praised OANN, that's One America News Network, which is basically further to the right of Fox.
Yeah, thank you to OANN, One America News, for your fair coverage and brilliant reporting. Is appreciated by many people trying so hard to find a new, consistent, and powerful voice. All caps on voice. I see you tonight at the big rally in Minneapolis.
Wow.
Which itself was a big shit show.
I guess, you know, I guess Trump doesn't like Crow very much.
No.
Apparently.
And then
finally, you get tired of it after a while.
There's also interesting stuff that happened with Fox News with Chef Smith leaving today.
Yeah.
I think today was his last day, I think.
Because apparently Rudy Giuliani had a talk with, I think it was Rupert Murdoch earlier this week.
Bill Barr did.
Oh, Bill Barr did.
Yes.
Yeah, people are thinking, could that be involved somehow? Or is it that just Shep Smith was at the point, he's like, fuck it, I can't take this shit anymore. I'm the one person who's trying to do actual... I'm like one of two people who's actually trying to do real fucking journalism on this network, and I can't fucking take it anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the people that he didn't mention, you know, Mr. Confused Face all the time,
Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. And I forget what the other ones are, but yeah, like, hey, he's just talking shit about people. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, these are the people that helped were your choir boys and girls. for the entire election. Like, just now, this poll comes out, and they're the worst thing that's ever happened to them.
I mean, if 51% was enough to get him into office, it should be enough to get him out of office.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And then finally, and this was just yesterday, two of Giuliani's associates that were helping him with the Ukraine shit, two people who have been photographed several times with both President Trump and members of his staff and members of his family, were arrested on campaign finance charges. And apparently they were getting ready to leave the fucking country because they bought a couple of one-way tickets.
Yeah, federal prosecutors said the men had one-way tickets to leave the U.S. when they were arrested at Dulles Airport by the FBI. Mm-hmm. Two men had no plans to return, officials said, and no destination was disclosed.
Yeah, that's totally something an innocent person would do.
Oh, totally. Yeah, you always go on plane trips and just, you know, just buy the one-way ticket.
Probably had a few $1,000 in cash on them, too.
Yeah, I mean,
probably a fake beard somewhere.
Yeah, and these guys work for Giuliani.
Yeah.
They helped out.
They were noping the fuck out of there.
Yeah, and they were also one of the guests at the exclusive Trump inauguration party.
Hmm. Yeah.
So there's like photographs of them with Trump, with Trump Jr. and Eric and Giuliani and fucking Melania and Ivanka and Jared Kushner and just every one of them.
Yeah. 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 So there's a 4-count indictment on this that has been unsealed, includes charges of conspiracy, making false statements to the Federal Election Commission, falsification of records. The documents allege an elaborate scheme to help an unnamed Ukrainian government official and a person who is described as having quote unquote Russian roots gain access to U.S. politicians and government officials through campaign contributions in order to advance business and personal financial interests. Gee, huge surprise. As the investigators said, the probe was ongoing. Parnas and Furman face up to 35 years in prison should they be convicted and receive the maximum sentence on the 4 counts they were charged with.
I suppose it's nice to know that our FBI still operates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that they can catch someone after they've bought one-way tickets, that they've kind of got a bead on shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems like they've been tailing them for a while.
Yeah.
Kind of had a good idea, like, because it's Giuliani. That he doesn't hide anything, because he can't.
He's an idiot.
He's got drunk mind 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's because he's drunk 150% of the time.
It's literally the only reason why people in the media have been inviting him on. Because it's like almost guaranteed he's going to reveal something that shouldn't be revealed.
But May 2018, the two men gave $325,000 to the pro-Trump Super PAC America First Action through an LLC, Global Energy Producers. The group confirmed to NBC News. Same month, Parnas posted photos on Facebook of himself and Furman with Trump and with the president's oldest son, Donald Trump Jr.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Fun. Oh, yeah. All right. Oh, that's not the end of the Trump news, though, because we also found out this week that a federal judge actually rejected Trump's appeal over the request for his tax returns in New York.
Good.
Yep.
And furthermore, the federal appeals court upheld the House's subpoena for Trump's tax returns.
Yeah, let's see. His comment on the New York thing. The radical left Democrats have failed on all fronts, so now they are pushing local New York City and state Democrat prosecutors to go get President Trump. A thing like this has never happened to any president before, not even close.
Well, that's because they all turned in their fucking taxes.
Yeah. see, the judge swept his client. Let's see. Trump's lawyers said that Vance's investigation is politically motivated and that the request for tax records should be stopped because Trump is immune from any criminal probe as long as he is president. The judge swept that claim aside as overly broad. As the court reads it, presidential immunity would stretch to cover every phase of criminal proceedings, including investigations, grand jury proceedings and subpoenas, indictment, prosecution, arrest, trial, conviction, and incarceration. That constitutional protection presumably would encompass any conduct at any time in any form, whether federal or state, and whether the president acted alone or in concert with other individuals. They're saying, like, You're basically saying you can do anything you want, not get in trouble for it.
That's not
even right. If it involves stuff that happened when you weren't president.
Exactly.
Or you have no claims of protections.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the federal appeals court one for the House is going to be pretty good to see how contrary to president's arguments, the committee possesses authority under both the House rules and the Constitution to issue the subpoena, and Mazars must comply.
Mm. All right.
So yeah.
All right.
Basically, suck it, Trump.
Yeah. Well, speaking of courts, the Supreme Court's new term began this week, and they got some pretty big cases on the docket. One of the big ones being a LGBT workplace discrimination case.
Yeah, and concerning the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which allows discrimination because of sex, protects gays, lesbians, and transgender employees from being fired. That's basically what they're trying to decide. California, 21 other states prohibit such discrimination, but Congress has not added that protection to federal law. So that's going to be a big test. Let's see. There's one for the Dreamers.
Mm-hmm.
Was the president justified in revoking the Obama-era rule that shielded deportation of more than 700,000 young immigrants who entered the country illegally as children? That'll be the thing they're trying to figure out.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's one involving guns and city regulations. Can a city restrict gun owners from carrying a handgun in their car? It's an unusual New York City ordinance that allows residents to keep a legal handgun at home, but prohibiting them from transporting it even to a second home outside the city. The court has never ruled directly on whether the Second Amendment protects a right to carry a gun in public. So that'll be an interesting one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. State aid for church schools, which will be an interesting one to see. See, 2 years ago, the court broke new ground by ruling the First Amendment's protection for the free exercise of religion forbids discrimination against churches when the government gives grants to private groups. Most states, however, have constitutions that forbid giving tax money to churches. Montana Supreme Court, citing its constitution, blocked a state scholarship fund from giving money to students attending church-related schools. The Trump administration argues such discrimination is unconstitutional because it imposes, quote, a special disability on religious schools because they are religious.
Yeah. It does. We're fucking America.
Yeah, but then you also need to be concerned about the way that churches are not supposed to be used for politics.
Though
Trump has.
If they want the money, and if they want to be in politics, let's tax them on their land. Let's tax them on their earnings.
Especially because we don't really have laws on what constitutes a church. There's no real finite description of what that means.
Yeah.
Which allowed John Oliver to essentially get his show registered as a church for a few weeks until part of the seed donations they got included actual human seed.
Yep.
Oh, my word.
Oh, God.
And they are like, yeah, we're done.
Okay, yeah. I could see them noping out of that too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Plenty of people send them money. Some people send them foreign money, which like we can't do anything with this, and actual seed, and a bunch of other shit. Good. Dick statues, bobbleheads, all this other weird shit.
Dick statues.
But yeah, that'll be interesting to see. Let's see. Another one, public corruption and fraud. It's a crime for a public official to give a deceptive reason for redirecting the spending of government funds. Justice has been skeptical of vague laws that give prosecutors too much leeway to decide what is a crime and who is a criminal. In June, they agreed to hear an appeal from Bridget Kelly, a former aide to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was convicted of fraud in the so-called Bridgegate scandal. Prosecutors said she and others conspired to shut down two lanes of the George Washington Bridge into Manhattan as part of a traffic study, when in fact their aim was to punish a Democratic mayor who had not endorsed Christie's reflection.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
And there's more stuff: abortion and ultrasound images.
Yeah.
Can Indiana require women seek an abortion undergo an ultrasound the day before so they may view the developing fetus? So yeah, that's
gonna no.
As abortion protests and free speech.
No.
Can Chicago and other cities enforce an 8-foot bubble zone outside abortion clinics to shield patients and the staff from sidewalk counselors?
Well, yes.
That would like That would work against them, because all they're going to see in one of those ultrasounds is what everybody calls the bean.
Yeah. Because, you know, we have a law in this country against voluntary abortions after the third trimester.
Right. And
if you've – I don't – you know, despite what all that shit that you see for those – you know, those fucking protesters where they got, like, the fetus that looks like a fully grown baby. Up to the third trimester, it is literally a fucking bean with tiny little legs. Like, that's it. Like, it doesn't even have a heart yet.
Right. And, like, into the second trimester, you can start to see the skeleton starting and stuff like that. But, man, they don't look like shit until you get to be, like, 4 or 5 months pregnant. And so all of these ultrasounds are also a way to further punish the woman for being a woman.
That's what it's about.
Yeah.
Because
it's not about the fucking about.
They're painful. These are internal ultrasounds. You get a big wand jabbed up your hoo-ha, and they pound it through your cervix almost, trying to figure out what the fuck's in your womb.
Like, look, I've, you know, I'm doing medical coding and stuff like that. I've seen what one of those fucking wands look like. That thing has to go up there almost to the hilt.
It really does. And they have to angle it around. Mm-hmm. Not just being in there. They have to move it all over the fucking place. And it hurts like a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what are the fake abortion clinics called?
Crisis centers.
Pregnancy crisis centers.
And like that's that whole thing. That's like the whole gimmick for that thing is they try to lie to fake that they're an abortion clinic, trick women to come in, and fake all that sort of shit.
And in any other country, they would be patently illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And here, they're allowed to do whatever they want, basically.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like a freedom of religion thing or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is just harassment, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Anyway,
the last one is one involving homeless and sleeping on sidewalks.
Oh, so, God damn it. Haven't they suffered enough?
Yeah, ruling a case from Boise, Idaho, said a city violates the Eighth Amendment and its ban on cruel and unusual punishment. It imposes criminal sanctions against homeless individuals for sleeping outdoors on public property when no alternative shelter is available.
Yeah. Or, you know, you could do what some other places are doing is, you know, give them a home.
Yeah.
Give them a home.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be a fancy home. Just give them a home.
Got tons of land.
Tons of land and a bunch of places that are going unused.
Yeah, like there's lots of essentially fake neighborhoods that were used for like military drills and such. It's like,
yeah.
Live in those homes. Build them up a little bit, but it's all like Jimmy Carter's thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you got to do a little bit of work on it if they've been blown to shit.
But
they're usually just abandoned homes.
Yeah.
They're just built to just be empty buildings.
Oh, so they're not actually firing off ordnance in there.
Yeah. I read somewhere that in the United States alone, there's like for every one person who is homeless, there's like four homes that are completely empty.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are just properties that some asshole buys just to
sit on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's true.
You guys are starting to realize why I tend to read Marx so much.
No, I never had to wonder.
All right. So, and next up. Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yes. Okay. Fuck, where to begin? Okay, so everybody realizes that there's been shit going down in Hong Kong for about a month and a half now, right?
Yeah.
And basically, this is shit that traces back about 20-some-odd years. I think a lot of people know for the longest time Hong Kong was a British colony, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, and I think it was in 1997 or 1998, Hong Kong was finally handed over back to China. And since then, Hong Kong has operated under a system that's known as one country, two systems, where Hong Kong is basically a autonomous protectorate that basically can operate under its own system while China operates under their system. But ever since then, there's been this big conflict between people on the island and people on the mainland about encroachments onto what was going on in Hong Kong. There's been stories of, like, you may have heard the stories of the disappearing booksellers who were apparently selling literature that may or may not have been critical of the Communist Party of China and simply just up and disappeared.
Disappeared.
Or you may have heard about these extradition bills going forward that people were afraid that if it got into law, it would allow China to basically use it as a workaround to pick up political dissidents. The original extradition bill that set all of this off was specifically about criminals who had committed a major crime in China and escaped to Hong Kong, and not like political or ideological offenses, but like murder, robbery, rape, extortion. Specifically, the guy that was sort of like the poster child for this was a dude who basically killed his girlfriend and then fled to Hong Kong to escape
being
arrested. Basically, this was just like – also on top of that, Hong Kong has been dealing with some serious economic stratification. I mean, Hong Kong economically has always been kind of fucked. You know, like there's a reason why all of those movies that you see coming out of Hong Kong, all of them usually – it's either like an opulent mansion or like a fucking slum.
Yeah.
It's because that's basically what Hong Kong is. And so you've got all these – and the thing is, although technically, you know, again, the parties in Hong Kong is an autonomous region politically. It does – the main parties there more or less answer to whatever the Communist Party of China says. So there's a lot of people who feel like they don't really have much of a political autonomy. But on top of this, there's also the fact that the working poor and the homeless – within Hong Kong, a majority of them actually support the Communist Party of China. Because, you know, if you don't know, for the last 30 years or so, the Communist Party of China has been getting involved in these heavy home building and infrastructure building initiatives.
Yeah.
With, like, lots of, like, generous welfare stuff going along with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these guys who basically support the Communist Party of China. Then you've got all of the sort of political dissidents, the middle class, and what you could basically call the Hong Kong bourgeois getting not liking the fact that they feel like their economic feel like their businesses are being taken away from them, or their autonomy to be able to run their business how they see fit is being taken with it. And basically you combine all of that, and then this one extradition bill was just the straw that broke the camel's back. And now, ever since then, Hong Kong has basically been on fire 24/7.
Yeah.
And China's doing some nasty shit to try to get them to stop.
Well, not necessarily China. It's the Hong Kong police.
But I'm sure they're directed by China.
Yeah, it's possible. The thing is, I'm just gonna keep it straight. This whole thing is really fucking complicated. Much is like what happens with like North Korea, you have to be really careful about the information you're getting, because both powers that are sympathetic to Hong Kong and powers that are sympathetic to the People's Republic of China, and of course the Chinese governments themselves and the dissidents in Hong Kong themselves, have basically been putting out these propaganda blitzes. And much as like with North Korea, where you have to be really careful about what you're getting, because there's basically these sort of mini industries that have been built up around it, basically trying to give out information and propaganda on either side. If you feel really confused and you don't really know who you feel like is someone you should be sympathizing with, you are completely – it is completely acceptable to just throw up your hands and say, I just hope for the best. That is okay, because honestly, I don't know who to support here either. I really fucking don't.
It's tough, but yeah, like the first thing kind of set all this off is a tweet from Daryl Morey, GM for the Houston Rockets in the NBA.
Yeah.
Which, if you don't know, the Houston Rockets are kind of the biggest team in China.
Yeah.
Because they were the ones that drafted
Yao Ming,
who was, you know, essentially the son of China, the first Chinese player to get drafted to the NBA.
Yeah.
And they became essentially the official mascot for China in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of even changed their logo to be a bit more Chinese in ways. It was kind of more interesting once I read somebody posting that. It was pretty interesting. But yeah, the...
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. I can actually see it.
Yeah. But yeah, a few hours posted this image that said, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." Deleted it after this all went off. But hours later, the owner of the Rockets, Tillman Fertitta, tweeted, "Listen, Daryl, does not speak for the Houston Rockets. Our presence in Tokyo is all about the promotion of the NBA internationally, and we are not a political organization." I was like, basically just throwing him under the bus at 11:54 p.m. at night.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, sure. That's it's awfully fast for the owner to be trolling Twitter for this shit, but not surprising. Very much as Houston's in a very unique position in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
To be like rocking the Chinese boat. And that caused fans in China and the Chinese government going through their various channels in China to denounce the NBA, the Houston Rockets, this guy and all that. See, the Chinese Basketball Association said it's to suspend all cooperation with the team. China's Consulate General in Houston also urged the team to clarify and immediately correct the mistakes, which I think means fire his ass. Which, to be clear, Daryl Morey is one of the most respected GMs in the league. He gets fired, he'd immediately have a job with any other team.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of the position he's in. Like, he would not really get punished other than just be out of the pressure of Houston as far as this Chinese stuff is going.
Yeah.
Let's see. He'd be getting more
for his services, and in the end, he'd get a huge raise.
Yeah. CCTV5, the sports channel, China's top state broadcaster, announced it would suspend airing Houston Rockets game events on television. More than 600 million people in China watched those games. See, Tencent Sports said it would suspend live streaming the games, as well as reporting news about the team. Nearly 500 million people in China watched NBA program on Tencent platforms last year.
Oh, fucking course.
Yeah, let's see. On the October 7th, Monday, the NBA responded finally. Said it recognizes that Morey's views have deeply offended many of our friends and fans in China, which is regrettable. While Daryl has made it clear that his tweet does not represent the Rockets or the NBA, the values of the league support individuals educating themselves and sharing their views on matters important to them. We have great respect for the history and culture of China and hope that sports and the NBA can be used as a unifying force to bridge cultural divides and bring people together. Let's see. And it's been criticized by a bunch of people. A platform that gets Senator Rick Scott and Beto O'Rourke both being critical of the NBA on the same side, which that's a hell of an accomplishment.
Yeah.
But yeah, Daryl apologized on his Twitter. So far, nothing has happened, but the NBA is kind of in a weird position because they're probably the most progressive of all the sports leagues here in this country. They're very much willing to allow their players to openly support social causes, both on and off the court.
Mm-hmm.
And all that, which is not China's policy on any of this stuff.
Oh, no.
They do not like any of that.
No.
So very much anybody in the NBA, much less somebody that's face of the Houston Rockets, talking about Hong Kong positively, is setting off a huge bomb.
Yeah.
That's basically going to test every public company that does business in China. Like,
yeah.
All right, who's in for the money? Who's in for other ideals as an American company or Western company.
And then furthermore, ESPN basically sent out a statement telling their on-air talent, yo, keep your mouth shut.
Not really that, but saying don't talk about the political side of all this.
Yeah.
They talked about the basketball side of it, which for as big as the story is, it's not the most interesting part. Because the irony of all this going down...
Probably all they're qualified to talk about, to be fair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the irony of all of this is that there are NBA teams playing basketball in China right now.
Yeah.
As part of their preseason stuff. I think even Houston was playing over there just for the irony of all this going down and having actual American players and players in other countries and all that playing over there. In a place that's kind of like a ticking time bomb, but there are activists with Free Hong Kong shirts and such showing up at the games, getting taken away. No idea what happens to them after that, but they're not at the game anymore. So yeah, lots of stuff that is just pretty weird and interesting.
Yeah. And then finally, Apple decided to remove an app from their store that was being used by protesters to track police by China's request. So,
So, Apple loves China.
Was probably one of the worst and most needly mouthed things that I have ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually did something that I have never seen before. It managed to get the Apple fanboys upset.
At Apple.
Wow.
Yeah, what they said is, let's see, the app displays police locations. We have verified with the Hong Kong Cybersecurity and Technology Crime Bureau that the app has been used to target and ambush police, threaten public safety, and criminals have used it to victimize residents in areas where they know there is no law enforcement.
Which is bullshit.
Yeah, that's propaganda. Because what they use it for is to know where the cops are mobilizing so they can not be there.
Yeah.
To know where their protests can be most effective instead of running into a bunch of police, especially when they're starting to disguise themselves as protesters over there.
Mm-hmm.
And doing all that sort of – they just put out a ban on face masks because they have facial recognition cameras.
That's why suddenly you're starting seeing people wearing surgical masks now.
Mm-hmm.
Or gas masks or stuff like that.
Yeah, there are videos of them doing cool stuff like tearing down the facial recognition cameras and such because they know like they want to do that so they can identify who's who and take whatever penalties they can on them.
Mm-hmm.
And face masks was the easier way to deal with all that.
Yeah.
So, of course, the government's no way they're being influenced by China. Being pushed to ban that stuff.
Yeah.
Just making things worse, really.
Yeah.
It's like they're doing all the wrong things. If they wanted this to end, they're doing all the wrong things.
Yeah.
So they're just agitating the people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And obviously there's one other major story involving this, involving another major company, but we're going to save that for day zero.
Yeah.
At least right now.
Yeah.
Things could fucking change this weekend.
Yeah. I want to remind everyone, I'm not going to tell you which side to pick because I honestly don't know myself. Hong Kong really does have a really good, case to make about shit like this. But on the other hand, the government of the People's Republic of China isn't entirely in the wrong here either. If they were smart, if China was really smart, Hong Kong isn't really like a major economic hub for China anymore. If they really wanted to, all they would have to do is just cut the cord.
Yeah.
Just cut them loose. But they won't do that because they want to save face.
Yeah. Pride to do anything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. For all the ways on the one hand, smart, they can be very, very dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on the one hand, there are some pretty malicious players in Hong Kong that are exploiting this shit. And on the other hand, don't try to fucking gin up the Xi Brigade and tell me that, China is just all misunderstood and shit.
No, that's what they want you to think.
I will openly admit that when it comes to talking about China, there are a lot of nuances and stuff that get left out in the discourse. And I also will admit that, you know, despite how some people portray it, China isn't quite the Orwellian dystopia as people sometimes portray it as. But I'm also not going to fall for your self-serving bullshit either.
Yeah.
And don't fucking, like, try to guilt trip me by weaponizing accusations of racism and xenophobia. Yeah. Okay, because people fucking do that shit to me all the goddamn time.
Yeah, that's not going
to
work out.
It's like, you want me to sympathize with China, you're just making it even harder.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Anyway. Yeah. All right.
One of the interesting things that happened with the whole NBA thing is the owner of the Brooklyn Nets spoke up, who, if you don't know, he is one of the execs at Alibaba, one of the biggest retailers in China. So he very much had very much a sympathy story for China, with like their whole story about what happened in World War II, when Japan was very much attacking them constantly and trying to take land from them, mm-hmm. all that, and like trying to build this weird sympathy story that a lot of people saw through. Because he has obvious ties to China, wanting, because China likes to do business around the world, but also wants to push their authoritarianism on countries that don't do that shit.
Mm-hmm.
Especially businesses. It's like, we're an American company. We're going to let people talk because that's what we are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting test to put to a lot of these companies that do business. Like, all right, where are you going to put your money when the things get serious?
Yeah.
And see, like, okay, who's here to kowtow to China and who's not?
Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's the end of the serious portion of the show, thank God.
Yeah, because that got heavy.
Oh, yeah. So next up in science news, the Mars Curiosity rover, of course, is up on Mars, and it's been doing shit, and it found some mineral salt deposits in a crater that used to be a lake.
Yeah. So they were at the Gale Crater, a 100-mile-wide ancient basin that Curiosity is exploring. Streams might have laced the crater's walls running towards its base. And they kind of see examples of these rocks that are enriched in mineral salts. As evidence of shiny, briny ponds that went through episodes of overflow and drying through this whole thing. Kind of just seeing more and more evidence of where water was at, sort of it doing the same things that it does here.
Yeah.
Because they were finding a lot of similarities between like what evidence they have on Mars compared to like the salt flats and such we have here on Earth. Yeah, it shows some examples of like the Kisquiro salt flat in South America's Altiplano. That kind of has very much the makings of what they think it would have been like, especially because it's a very vegetation-free area. So, yeah, some really cool stuff they're finding over there.
Yeah, I'm just kind of thrilled that the Curiosity rover is still puttering around up
there. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. It might give a lot of insight into how the solar system formed, how the planets are forming. And there's a little bit of news that I didn't put on here. Someone donated to our one of our local museums here in Chicago a chunk of a meteor. And it has a lot of potential to also tell us how the solar system formed, how water got to where it did and how it didn't. So it said that it'll take probably about a good 50 years to study all that and slowly release the findings.
Yeah.
If Earth is still, you know, not on fire by then.
Yeah.
And next up, more science news. Saturn is officially the king of the moons because this week 20 new moons were discovered.
Yeah, so how many moons
Where were they hiding?
nowhere. It's just they have better technology to kind of further analyze like all the rocks that are going around Saturn, figure out what's a moon, what's not. But how many moons do you think Saturn has now?
About 60.
82.
Holy shit.
Yeah, Jupiter had the most at 79, and this kind of pushed it, Saturn over Jupiter's, to be the new king of moons in the solar system.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, they discovered 20 new moons in orbit around Saturn, and let's see, by the International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center. They're partnered with the Carnegie Institution for Science. So there's about 100 even tinier moons maybe orbiting Saturn still waiting to be found. Using some of the largest telescopes in the world, we're now completing the inventory of small moons around the giant planets. They play a crucial role in helping us determine how our solar system's planets formed and evolved. Each of the newly discovered moons is about 3 miles in diameter. 17 of them orbit the planet backwards or in a retrograde direction.
Ooh.
Meaning their movement is opposite of the planet's rotation around its axis. The other three moons orbit in the same direction as Saturn rotates. So, they used a telescope in Hawaii to spot Saturn's 20 new moons over the past few months. No names yet, but they're also asking for help from the public.
Oh god!
Moony moon face.
No.
Sorry.
Yeah, but they. I think they.
Stupid.
Well,
they're gonna delete all the ones that are stupid. But yeah, that's gonna be good ones. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully, fewer Game of Thrones references.
Yeah. All
right. But yeah.
And next up, we got a story out of my neck of the woods, Georgia. The snakehead has officially shown up in Georgia. They are a fish that can survive on land.
Oh, those fuckers.
Yeah.
Northern snakeheads.
Yeah, the Department of Natural Resources has basically said, yo, if you see one of these, kill the fucker.
Yeah.
Immediately. Yeah.
They can breathe air and survive for days on land.
Mm-hmm.
Basically saying, let's see, one, do not release it. Two, kill it immediately and freeze it. They can survive on land. Three, if possible, take pictures of the fish, including close-up of its mouth, fins, and tail. Note where it was caught, like the water body, landmarks, or GPS coordinates. Immediately report it to your regional Georgia DNR Wildlife Resources Division Fisheries Office. It's considered invasive when it moves into an ecosystem as an evolved to control it. So they're where he's going to start killing off a bunch of other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
These are native to Asia.
Yeah. So
managed to get over here.
Kind of like another invasive species that basically devoured all of Georgia.
Kudzu!
Yep.
Yeah. I wonder if this is good eating,
though. Let's see.
I don't want to be the one to find out.
No, yeah, apparently they are. They are a prized food fish.
Problem solved?
In Vietnam... Burma, Indonesia, yeah. So very prized in Asian cuisine.
Yeah, tell the fishing companies to come to Georgia.
Yeah.
New industry.
Yep. All right. Next up, there's going to be a John Wick spinoff called Ballerina, and we're going to have a woman lead.
Yep.
How many people is she going to kill?
We'll see. Yeah, Len Wiseman is directing this. It'll be focused on a young female assassin who seeks revenge against the people who killed her family.
Yeah, totally sounds like John Wick.
Yeah, it's on a fast track with script by Shea Hatton. His credits include Army of the Dead, Zack Snyder's new movie for Netflix, and John Wick Chapter 3. So, yeah, got the people in charge that should be in charge.
Yeah.
Seems like.
Yeah, I didn't like the first John Wick movie, but actually I found the second one and third one a lot better.
And finally, last story for the night, CBS is making a miniseries based on James Comey's book.
Yeah, they've got, they got Jeff Daniels to play James Comey, Brendan Gleeson to play Donald Trump, and I believe after this they announced they've got Helen Hunt to play... what was it? I forget what the person's name is, but yeah, she's also going to be in it. It'll be interesting to see how that turns out. It's going to be, where is it? Say how long it's going to be. I thought it was going to be like 4 hours, something like that. Like
three or four
episodes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, it's going to be in production next month, mm-hmm. and probably air sometime next year.
Yeah. Hopefully Trump will be gone by then.
Yeah, we can hope. Otherwise, he'll complain about this, too.
Oh, yeah. Mm. All right. All right, well, I do believe we got ourselves a show, folks. Yep. God damn, that got heavy.
Yeah.
Fuck. Let's hope it doesn't get heavy again next week.
Yeah.
Well, but with that, I would like to remind all of our listeners that if you have a question, a comment, something you want us to read on the air, you can get in touch with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got it listed for you in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or pretty much any kind of podcast aggregator you can probably think of. And so, with that being said, I have been your host with the most, Brandon Perkins, and for Filippo D'Onofrio, Patrick Mifflin, Chris Elogi, and Teresa Sammons, good night. Goddamn, Day Zero Update's going to be intense.